the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 272 for Wednesday, July 7th, 2010.
To the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab here from very sunny and very warm Durham, New Hampshire. I am Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun, also very sunny. We got heat warnings and air quality warnings and a great day to be inside next to the AC.
I was going to say, and I believe you are pretty much right next to the AC there, John, if we can see
yes,
your
I am.
View. Mm-hmm. And I said we can see your view. We are trying the experiment again. So this show was broadcast live video on Ustream, and the Ustream for this show will be available as an archive, too. So from time to time, you may hear us refer to the chat room, but we do always either remember or attempt to remember that there are, of course, far more of you out there listening audio only. So we will keep that in mind and explain anything and promise not to just come up with a reference out of nowhere. Although we do that anyway, we'll keep that down to a minimum. All right. Let's jump right in and go to Chris. Does that sound good, John?
This is very timely, especially in light of the
I know
weather conditions.
Yep. So Chris writes, Chris in Ohio with a perplexing problem that began after a recent power outage during a thunderstorm. My Mac Mini seems to think the Ethernet cable is unplugged, though it is most certainly plugged in. My wireless connection on the Mac Mini works fine, and while it's nice to at least have some form of an internet connection, I'd still like to get the Ethernet working again. Having been in the family tech support for 20 years, I can usually solve most computer problems, but I must concede to you guys for your greater geekdom on this one. I have my late 2008 Intel Mac Mini connected to a Linksys WRT-160N wireless router, which is in turn connected to my cable modem. Here are the steps that I have taken so far. I've checked for a bad Ethernet cable and ruled that out. I took the Mac Mini out of the equation by plugging its Ethernet cable into the MacBook Pro. Worked fine. Swapped the cables. Worked fine. I felt this eliminated the doubt. Number two, plug the Mac Mini directly into the cable modem with both Ethernet cables. No change. It still showed unplugged. Number three, plug the MacBook Pro directly into the cable modem with both Ethernet cables. It connected both fine with both cables. Therefore, yes, we've proven the cables work, and we've also proven that the port on the router is good. I've checked DNS settings. I've reset the PRAM and power management on the Mac Mini. And I upgraded the Mac Mini to Snow Leopard. It was previously on Leopard. So that's good troubleshooting, Chris. I think, in fact, that's excellent troubleshooting, if you ask me. And unfortunately, John, I think it leaves but one option left, and that is a favorite topic of ours, which is lightning.
Oh.
Power short.
That's your
short.
Favorite topic. I have yet in my lifetime. Favorite. No, it's not. But yeah, you seem to be more prone to it than I am. I've never had a piece of electronics suffer from a lightning strike, which means, of course, that lightning's going to hit the house.
That's right.
Any minute now.
That's right. Well, I've had three lightning strikes here at this particular house. And yeah, we'll post a link to the article that I wrote. I know we talked about it on a bunch of the shows, but I also posted an article, I think last year, where I pretty much detailed my experience and then also the advice that that I would come up with, which really is get not only UPS units, which protect against surges and brownouts, which are those short little outages that can really, really cause trouble. But the UPS is a battery backed up surge protector is essentially what that is, though that's an oversimplification of the product. But in addition to that, you want to get Ethernet surge protectors and telephone surge protectors if you've got those connected up, and then coax surge protector for your line coming in if you have a cable modem. And sometimes the UPS unit will be able to do one or all three of those. Sometimes you'll have to get separate units to do that. But that's the problem. And that's what you've got here, Chris. In fact, the situation you describe could very well have been with the Mac Mini plugged into a surge protector or even a UPS. But Lightning is always going to go for the quickest path to ground, which, if it can't go through the surge protector, is going to go through Ethernet or any sort of DC DC power. What am I trying to say here, John?
Yeah.
Anything that runs DC power, which would be your Ethernet port. And my guess is the port's fried, unfortunately, on that machine. Of course, I think that means the motherboard, and that can get pretty pricey. So,
yeah. The things that I would offer, additional things to try, yeah, though, his troubleshooting was pretty darn thorough.
Yes.
I've seen this sometime, though I'm with you. I believe it's been zapped. One thing you may want to try is if you go into System Preferences and Network, click on Ethernet, delete it. There'll be a little minus sign, and try to add it again.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen this work for some odd problems. It certainly can't hurt to try it. Another thing is if you go into the terminal, there is a command ifconfig -a, I believe it is, which will show you the status of all the interfaces that are defined.
Right.
And I'm guessing it may not even show up, or it's going to say that it's down. And then the last thing that occurs to me, and Apple, I'm not sure about the current minis or the past minis. I know this is true on the time capsule, but there's usually some sort of light. Usually, I think Apple just has like one light, a little green light.
Right.
You may want to see if that's lit up. I'm betting that it's not. I bet that it's, or it may be, but the port is still shot. But I've seen that most Apple equipment, a lot of equipment, I see that there's two lights. Usually there's a green light, which indicates, yeah, the port's okay, and then like a yellow light that shows activity. So again, I'm not sure if the Mini has one or both of those. But yeah, I think it's shot, in which case he's done all he can to try to track it down.
Yeah, as Coder Kev in the chat room for our Ustream chat suggested, AppleCare, of course, is the first step, because they will take care of it if in fact you have AppleCare. I got an email back from Chris. I'd actually suggested that, and unfortunately, he said no, he did not have AppleCare. The other thing I suggested is homeowners insurance. They are there to cover things like this. Now, depending on your plan, it may be subject to your deductible, and if it's subject to your deductible, probably not worth it, depending on what your deductible is. I mean, if you got a low deductible, a couple $100, maybe, sure, might as well. You're paying for it. But you know, if you keep your deductible high, $1,000 or whatever, then obviously you're much better off going it on your own and not filing a claim. So
it's very sad. Now, even though this was not, you know, the fault of the machine, I think, yeah, as long as you maybe feign ignorance, I think AppleCare may take care of it. Just say, port stopped working.
Yeah, no, they're pretty cool about that. I think it was a port on my time capsule that was fried by lightning, and they were like, yeah, no problem. So,
okay.
All right. On to another dead piece of hardware. We'll see what Brian has to say.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Brian in Philadelphia. I have an old iMac G5. I think John has one like mine. It's a ambient light sensor unit, 17-inch. But anyway, it died this past New Year's Day after working perfectly up until then. I've since replaced the machine, but I was wondering about trying to repair it for my wife, who uses an even older iMac, but it's 100% for email and web surfing, and that's it. Now, when this G5 failed, it gave no symptom or sign. It just refused to start at all. It was plugged into a UPS, by the way, so I'm thinking that power surge or something might not be that likely. Anyway, I finally found an Apple support document. It's called Article HT2173, which gave an excellent troubleshooting exercise for this exact issue. By the way, I'm not afraid to operate on these babies, having replaced the hard drive in this machine and the optical drive myself on this unit. Yes, I do have Torx screwdrivers. Anyway, the troubleshooting procedure worked It involved opening up the iMac and checking four LEDs internally inside with the power connected. In short, it says that if LED number one is not lit with the power connected, then according to Apple, the power supply needs to be replaced. So that's going to cost maybe $150. But, and again, I'm not afraid to do it. But here's my question. In your opinion, and believe me, I'm just looking for an educated opinion. What are the chances that the power supply just failed and that the logic board is probably still okay versus if the logic board was fried normally when the power supply went out? Are those two things intrinsically related? Or is it worth a $150 gamble to replace the power supply and just see if the bugger will come back to life? That's my question. If you could just give me, again, an educated opinion about what you think the chances are that that attempted repair might be worthwhile doing, I'd appreciate it. Here's where you cut me off.
And so we shall. So Brian went out of his way to ensure that he wasn't going to come screaming and yelling at us that that our whatever advice we give is wrong if it turns out to be wrong. But John, you know, relating this to the previous question, you know, he said it died on New Year's Day and sounded like if there was some sort of storm, he would have mentioned that. He seemed to be that sort of a guy. He was very thorough in his his description. So being that it was New Year's Day, and in most areas of the country, I don't know where he was from, but I think he's in the U.S. And in most areas of the country, New Year's Day isn't exactly known for its lightning storms. Right.
As far as I know.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I'm going to guess that his power supply simply died. And that happens. In fact, I was the one that had that iMac G5 and I had my power supply die exactly like he's talking about. One day it had turned off and it wouldn't turn back on. And I'd forgotten about that Knowledge Base article that talks about those status lights on the motherboard. That's actually pretty cool. But there you go. So I think he's totally fine, you know, making the gamble. If he's comfortable putting in a new power supply, then yeah, go buy one and pop it in. I think it, I think he got, you know, 80% plus that's going to be the answer.
Yeah. So where you get that, because I actually found this one here to remind everybody, most of the support articles that we talk about, if we say it's HT, whatever, so he said it was HT2173.
Right.
Usually get to that support.apple.com/KB, which I'm going to guess is knowledge base slash, and then the article that we mentioned. So that's the part that we sometimes leave out because it's usually the same.
Right.
But yeah, I'm with you. I'm hoping that the mother, it's hard to say if he could actually tell the motherboard was damaged, short of, you know, seeing, you know, either smelling that terrible, you know, burnt electronic smell.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think now I'm not sure if any of the other lights went on, you know, that would lead me to believe that, well, I guess that first light, that's probably detecting some sort of, you know, trickle current or whatever coming out of the supply. And if that's off, then
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm sure you can get one of those either from Apple, or I don't know if they have a flat rate plan, or, you could get it through iFixit or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly. I think there's cheaper places than Apple to buy those. So cool. All right. Let's talk about our first sponsor, John, which is Smile on My Mac. And this time we're talking about Text Expander, which is oh so easy to talk about because it's so cool. So the idea behind Text Expander is you probably, like me, have all these snippets of text that you wind up typing regularly. It might just be your name. It might be your phone number. It might be a full signature. It might be your address. You know, for example, you know, we get sometimes I have to send my address and John's address in the same email to people, you know, if they're going to send us, something, whatever. And so instead of having to go and open up address book and, you know, remember what John's address is, let alone manually type it out, I have a little snippet. And so what I do with Text Expander, it runs system wide. I type comma JBADD and wherever my cursor is, boom, John's address is formatted and looks great. I do the same thing for mine. Even though I know my address, I just don't want to type it. Same thing with phone numbers. like I said, signatures, all that stuff. I have, you know, my office number, it's 0603, and bam, my phone number's out. Doesn't save me a ton of keystrokes, but it's not so bad. And the cool thing is, so you can run this on your Mac, $35, but of course you can go download a free trial at smileonmymac.com. In addition, they have an iPhone and iPad app, and it's in full glory on the iPad. I think it's $10. Yeah, no, $5. It's $5 on the App Store. And the cool thing is, two cool things. One, you can sync it with your Mac so that you have all the same snippets there that you have on your Mac, or a subset of them. I think you can pick which which groups you want to sync. The other cool thing is apps can use it, even though apps aren't supposed to be able to talk to each other on the iPhone and all that stuff. Text Expander did some magic where you have their app on your iPhone or iPad or your iPod Touch, and you sync your snippets, and then other apps like Twitter is one of them. I think Simple Notes another. It totally works. You know, the same snippets, and you sync them once with the Smile on My Mac app, and that's it. It works with everything. So. And it is Simple Notes, one of them. There's a whole big long list of them. There's like 30 now. It's cool stuff. So anyway, that's smileonmymac.com, Text Expander, and Text Expander Touch. And with that, John, let's move on to Jack, shall we?
We shall.
Okay. So, Jack writes, I was wondering if you could help with a persistent problem with my MacBook Pro on Snow Leopard 10.6.4. For some time now, my MacBook Pro has not been able to update any third-party software through the look for update features within the running software. The only way I've been able to do it has been to go to the manufacturer's website and download the software from there. They then install as if it was a first-time install. It was so much easier to update from within the software, and some manufacturer sites don't have the immediate access to downloadable disk files or disk image files, making it that much harder to keep up with current releases. I did fix permissions from the Snow Leopard DVD, but that did not help. I also have some software that will not install at all, like Neat Receipts for Mac Scanner software. A piece of hopefully helpful information is this started after I upgraded from 10.6.1 to 10.6.2, now on 10.6.4. When I originally bought this MacBook Pro mid last year from a third party, I used Migration Assistant to add my previous MacBook Pro's applications and files, and all went fine, or at least appeared to. So there's a couple different paths to head down with this one here, John. The path I headed down, and I'm not, in reading his question, I'm actually thinking this may not be it, but it's worth stating because I've seen it on others, is a permissions issue. Yes, I know he repaired permissions, but all that happens when you repair permissions is certain items' permissions are set to what Apple believes they should be set to. And those are right. I haven't ever seen Apple, get it wrong per se. But Apple does not have parameters set for third-party apps, so it doesn't touch their permissions. If their permissions are wrong, they will stay that way. And I've seen a problem similar to what Jack describes when doing when I have a machine with multiple users. If, for example, multiple users that are admins, so that can add things to the applications folder. If, for example, on this machine, if Lisa installs something like an update to QuickBooks, right? Then that update is actually owned by the user Lisa. If I try to update that, it will not let me. If I try to delete it, I have to authenticate, right? Or if I try to overwrite it, I have to authenticate. And you can check this out by going to the app in question and doing a get info on it. Apple apps will always or should always be owned by system and have read write privileges for the owner, and then both we, the group, and everyone have read privileges. But for third-party apps, they're always owned by the user that installed them. So it's possible that Jack had, with this migration from the old one, may have had, one user that's not active, but, owns most or all of the apps. So that's one thing, and it's certainly worth checking out. The applications folder itself, that should be system read write, admin read write, and everyone read only in terms of its permissions. And I believe repairing permissions will set it that way. That's the system-wide applications folder. But John, you had, I don't know if you got any thoughts on what I was just talking about, but I know you have some thoughts on your own too.
Yeah, sometimes. So here we go. So here's another thing. And actually, I think this is relevant. So you and I were tossing this around, wondering if it was relevant or not. And I think it is.
I think it is.
So the thing is software update. And now this was the caveat. I thought it was only software, or you and I thought it was only software update. But not just software update, but a lot of programs. Now, you may have seen this directory. If you go to your top level, library receipts.
Okay.
Now, if you look into receipts, now receipts is definitely where software update looks to keep track of what has been installed and versions and all that. But looking right here, and this is why I changed my... So at first I thought it was just software update that looks in there and just Apple software, but it's not. Like, for example, on my G5 here, just before I started the show, Adobe Reader came up and said, hey, you know, there's an update. You want me to apply it? And I'm looking in my receipts folder, and gee, you know what the very latest package is in here? Adobe Reader 930_EN_US_PPC.PKG.
Okay.
So what I'm going to suggest is that there may be a problem with the receipts folder, and that if whatever you're running, and you know, Adobe Reader is certainly not a piece of Apple software, though. I think they're using, so I think anything that uses the Apple installer framework will put something in the receipts folder to keep track of what's been happening.
Right. My question with that, though, is I don't think any of the third party update engines rely on that information. Right. I think because he's talking about updating from within the app. I think they're looking at the app itself. I don't think they're looking at the receipts folder, because a lot of these apps don't have a receipt.
I understand. Okay. But I'm going to say, for example, Adobe Reader is certainly not an Apple application. And I believe they have a feature within the app that says, hey, check for an update.
Right.
So
that's right.
So I'm going to say it's a possible place.
Yeah,
And as you suggested, maybe the permissions on that are not right. And whatever's trying to look in there can't. And so it's concluding, there's nothing for me to update.
Sure.
And I'm going to look right now, get info. So I think similar to the other things. So system has read write, admin has read write, and everyone has read only.
On your applications folder itself?
To the receipts directory.
Oh, okay. Yep. Same as the apps folder. Okay. Okay.
Right. So to me, that's one possible issue.
Don't think anything you and I have mentioned is his issue, though, but I think what you're about to mention is.
Yes. Now, there are also like one very popular package that I've seen a lot of pieces of software use for updates is called Sparkle. And what this does, and I know this because I'm using or at least I like using Little Snitch, which can get to be a kind of a pain in the neck, because anytime. And so Sparkle is a framework that allows people to embed software update abilities, not Apple software update, but just the ability to phone home and say, hey, is there a new version of me? Oh, there is. Okay, I'm going to download it. And it's usually pretty cool, because a lot of times it'll download it and then actually install and restart the app. So it's pretty fluid and pretty nice. But what has to happen in this case, and actually this is the same thing with the Apple stuff, is if the network port that it uses is somehow blocked with something like Little Snitch or your firewall, or I mean, almost all of these things that I've seen use port 80 or port 443 to go out and say, hey, is there something new for me? So you may have either a firewall or Little Snitch or something that for whatever reason is blocking this network access, in which case you're never going to know there are updates because it's never going to be able to get out.
Okay, but if you're going to talk about Little Snitch, then I'm going to do something which I will do both virtually and physically for, you know, those people that are in the video room. But I am going to shake my fist at you for using Little Snitch. This is a classic example of why I think that 99% of the people out there shouldn't be using this software.
I agree.
But, you know, because it gets in the way, and you don't necessarily know that it's in the way. At some point, you know, an app, the first time it launched, it says, I want to phone home. And you said, well, this app is going to, like, you know, draw pictures on my screen. Right. I don't need to phone home. So to heck with that. And you turn it off. And then, 4 months later, you've got this problem. But here's the thing. So now I'm going to refute everything I've said, John, because if the... it sounds like, and I'm inferring here from Jack's email, but it sounds like he knows that the update's there, which means the app has phoned home and tried to install the update, but then failed, which brings us back to the application file permissions that I started with. So it's all full circle.
Now, the one last thing, and I've noticed this sometimes also with Apple and others, the update is not necessarily available via a network update, but it is available if you explicitly go to the site. I think I've seen this with Apple sometimes.
Yeah.
Because the problem is this causes a big dog pile on their network servers, and for whatever reason, if they're not prepared for the traffic, they may want you to explicitly go to a web page to get it. So I've seen cases where it's appeared as an explicit download before it's appeared on a software update type network server. So sometimes you may want to wait a day or so before you know that it's out there, before you actually use the network-based one to check for it. So, and yeah, I'm with you on Little Snitch. The one place where it does get in the way is with these routine, I would say, you know, tasks that are not a big security risk, like updating your software.
Yeah.
So on the other hand, I just like to see what my software is doing and who it's talking to.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, is it is kind of cool, right? To see what your software is doing. And that's cool. The problem is when you forget about it. Right. And mm-hmm. you know, you're troubleshooting around it and not realizing that, oh, hey, wait, there's this thing that's totally getting in the way. So.
Yeah. And actually, I think the majority of people in the chat room said Little Snitch rocks. So, well, one person said that. So.
One person did. That's right. Yeah. Despite the fact that the chat room is not huge, that does not constitute a majority. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, it's one versus zero. So to me, that's a clear majority.
Well, yeah.
Okay. One is greater than zero.
Uh-huh. Yes, that's true. That's true. Okay.
Anyways. Moving on, I'm totally with you. You may want to try Little Snitch. Give it a whirl. They have a trial. You may find it too intrusive, and yes, it can get in the way, because we had questions in the past where it was the problem. It was blocking some access, and the person had forgotten that they defined it. Because the problem is, you can define rules forever, and if you define a restrictive rule like that forever, you may never figure out that's what's causing your grief. So I'm with you.
Cool. All right. Let's see what Peter has to say.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Peter from Wisconsin. Called a few weeks, probably 2 or 3 months back, about network issues at a church. Realized that the reason why the network was screwing up was not because of cable length or anything else. It was because of the fact that there are 7 computers connected to a 5-port switch. Have your little laugh at that. And then recently they upgraded one of the computers from Windows XP to Windows 7. And the Mac they're working on suddenly lost all contact with a network shared printer that was on that XP machine. It turns out that the network is now set up as a Windows 7 home network. Really not sure why, but I guess, you know, some questions are better left unasked. Just had an idea as to how to find that printer again. Wanted to run by you and see if it would actually work. Using Bonjour, as far as I know, Windows 7 Home Network is a proprietary format for Windows only. At least that's what everything I'm reading about is telling me. Just wanted to know if installing, say, iTunes or Safari on that computer and bringing Bonjour along with it would allow me to access that printer. Hope to hear from you guys soon. Here's where you cut me off.
All right, hang on. Hey, I got him. I cut him off. All right.
Did you uncube? Okay.
I uncubed us. So,
cube going.
Yeah, go ahead. So you've got some thoughts on this one, John. Or do you want me to?
I do. I mean, I do. So okay. It sounded to me like here's what he was doing. So I had to listen a couple of times, but help me out here, Dave.
Yep.
I believe what he's doing is that he has a printer. Now, he said network shared printer, and I don't know if... I think what he's doing is this printer is either an Ethernet or maybe a USB printer. And similar to the Mac, Windows XP or Windows 7, if you have a printer plugged in, can share it with others over the network. Is that your understanding of what's happening here?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not entirely convinced that's what's happening. It's either
because I thought he said network shared printer is connected to the computer.
Yeah, which means that the printer is connected via the network, not via a USB cable.
Okay, that was not clear to me.
Yeah, it could go either way. It could be either way. But the good news is that it doesn't really matter, right? I mean, as long as Windows can see the printer, it can then share it in its own way. So,
I mean, the question that I have, and yeah, I actually found an article here that you know, that's called Share Files and Printers Between Windows 7 and Windows XP, which goes through the steps that you go through to share a printer with others. I guess my question is, yeah, is this printer plugged directly into the router if it is, in fact, a US Ethernet printer? Because I don't know, I've never been comfortable with plugging a printer into a computer and then sharing from the computer or using the computer to offer print sharing services. I've always depended on the printer itself to do it, assuming that the printer has the capability.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's assume for the sake of argument here that it's connected to the Windows machine via USB. It really doesn't matter, and we'll assume that it can't go back to the Mac. Right, it can't connect directly to the Mac. It can't connect directly to the network. We have to share it from this Windows machine.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So, with that, I think it's, you know, system preferences, right? Print and fax. I don't think it's going to show up in a Bonjour window, right? You're going to have to go and manually map the printer, which is system preferences, print and fax, and then add the printer, and then move over to the Windows section. Mm. It may show up there. In fact, hopefully it will. I don't have a magic answer beyond that.
No, I think the other thing he mentioned, I don't know if the printer has Bonjour abilities, but to do that, you have to install Bonjour for Windows.
Right. Right.
That's another solution, but it sounds like Windows 7 is the that's why I'm suspecting it may be something connected to the computer, and that I don't see any reason why if you upgraded a computer on the network that all of a sudden a printer that's not connected to the computer would disappear. So,
right.
Who knows what Windows 7 is doing? Actually, the other thing that I've seen, here's another one, is sometimes I've seen this more with file sharing on Windows. The firewall may, some sort of firewall may have engaged on the computer.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, anybody who shared anything with that computer all of a sudden cannot do that. And I think the article that I found, I think, goes into a little detail about how you could, well, I don't know if you necessarily want to disable the firewall, but you may be able to open a hole so that the print sharing will be made available to anybody who used to be sharing a printer that was connected to that computer. So that's another thought.
Yeah. Interesting. If anybody out there has any ideas, please feel free to share them. Anything else to add on this one, John?
Nope.
No. Okay. Moving on to Ed. Okay. You know, actually, we're not going to go to Ed next. We just had the same symptoms on Ustream that we've seen in the past, but it's a good opportunity to talk about network troubleshooting. So the issue was bandwidth that I was sending out from here was not consistently getting to Ustream and people couldn't see or hear us. So I paused the show and, you know, there was no reason to go through that because, of course, it's not relevant to the listeners. So we paused it and tried to deal with it. But the network troubleshooting that we went through for this is very interesting. And so what I did was my network is set up that I have my computers connected to a router, connected to the cable modem, connected to the internet. Right. So there's two tools that I use. One's called Traceroute and one's called Ping. Ping tells me if I can get an answer from any given server. Right, John? So.
Yes. That's I believe an ICMP
right.
message. It's one of these low level messages where, yeah, every piece of equipment along the way.
Right.
Should say, yeah, it's a way to get someone. And it usually, I think sometimes some people filter it. But for the most part, it's a message that says, hey, are you there? And if you're there, could you please, you know, respond to me?
Right. Right. So so the first thing I did was I started a ping of Mac Observer. And all I did was go to the terminal, type ping space macobserver.com, enter. And it just starts rolling. Some Unixes have a default limit to the amount of pings. Mac OS X does not. It will ping and ping and ping every second until you hit Control C to stop it. So now I see, okay, yep, every, you know, 15th ping, I'm missing one, which means that there's some packet loss out there. And that, of course, is non-desirable and indicative of this problem. So I then went and ran a speed test at speedtest.net. And it, you know, the downstream was okay. The upstream was terrible. So I knew, oh, okay, we're having this problem. So that's when I paused the show. Actually, that was after I paused the show. Then I did a trace route from me to MacObserver.com. And to do that, it's the same syntax as the ping. It's you type trace route, all one word, space MacObserver.com. And it gives you a whole long list of all the computers or routers rather between you and MacObserver.com. The one you may not, in fact, probably won't see is your cable modem. You'll probably see your router in your house. And then you'll see all the stuff that your ISP has, but you won't necessarily see your cable modem. I like, when I'm doing this, I like to open up another terminal window and ping my cable modem. And the cable modem is almost always at the same IP address, which is 192.168.100.1. And I get these two windows up next to each other. So I see pings to Mac Observer in one window, pings to my cable modem in the other. If I see breaks in the pings to Mac Observer, but no breaks to the cable modem, then I know that the problem is outside my network and not inside my network. Does that sound right, John?
That does sound right.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Let me try this ping 192.
So then I take a look at the trace route and
and that's good too, because you're going to see to differentiate between the ping of the cable modem and the ping of something like an Mac Observer, at least what I observed.
Right.
Pinging my cable modem was on the order. So things you'll see when you do the ping, one, it'll show you the size, which in this case is 64 bytes, which I think is the default. The other is the IP address. Then it's going to show a sequence number, which should increase sequentially.
Right.
TTL, which I think is time to live, which is the number of things the ping packet will go through before it gets thrown away. I think that's what that's for. And then it shows time. Like, for example, to my cable modem, it was on the order of between 1 and 2 milliseconds, which I would expect because it's sitting right here.
Right.
Observer, which I considered normal when I tried it, or I just tried it recently, Dave,
yeah,
was on the order of about 20 milliseconds,
yeah,
which to me sounds reasonable. I think when you got to start worrying is when these values, at least for things that should be close by, start to get into the hundreds or thousands of milliseconds. Then something somewhere is causing a problem.
Is not right.
Go on.
That's right. No, that's right. So then what I do is I look at the trace route and I look at one of the ones early in the trace route. I try to pick the one that's just past my router, being the first of Comcast's routers that I'm going to start messing with, you know. And so I start pinging that and I try to see where in that process I'm getting packet loss. I know I'm getting it at the end. I know I'm not getting it at the beginning. So where's the problem? And if it's right at Comcast router, previous issues that I had were right at the first router of Comcast, which told us that there was something wrong at the node or between me and the node. That's not happening right now. So the issue is, you know, internet congestion, presumably something to do with Comcast connecting out to the rest of the world. But it's not a problem to my neighborhood. It's not a problem with my cable modem. And it, you know, didn't take very long. It took, you know, a couple of minutes to diagnose that and figure it out. If I wanted to, and if I had the time, I could get on with, you know, Comcast, a customer service. I'd like to do it on the web with their live chat, but I'm not going to do that right now because I have a lot going on and we're podcasting. So we're just going to live with it. But it seems to have gotten better, but that's one way of troubleshooting to see really where along the chain your problem, if you're having one, is, and that packet loss can be a great indicator of where that problem is. Not always though, because some routers don't reply reliably because they're busy passing traffic. And so you've got to kind of get a baseline and figure that out first.
So. Mm-hmm. We had some good comments in the room here. So network utility, which is in utilities folder,
yep,
is a nice GUI way of OS X letting you do this.
That's right.
And then Mr. Haycock, oh, he's talking about ARP. I think that gets a little advanced.
Yeah, we'll skip ARP.
Address resolution protocol. But that'll be for another time.
That's right. That's right.
But now you said you did the speed test also, Dave. What happened there?
So I did two speed tests. I did speedtest.net, and then I also did speedtest.comcast.net. Ooh. And the speed test that I did at speedtest.net showed a very, very, very slow upstream. Then I did one at comcast.net, and it showed a very fast upstream. But then I did it again at speedtest.net because it was right about the time the problem was getting better. So I'm not sure if that was telling me anything valuable, to be honest with you at that point. But that's one thing I do is try, you know, the outer world speed test and the you know, inside the network Comcast speed test to see what's going on.
Now, one more thing. All right. So British Kev said this in the chat room, which, yep. And I think you could do this with machines as well. I don't recall exactly where on OS X you do this,
yep.
But there is a way to put your machine in what they call stealth mode.
Okay.
Which I think one of the things it does is it will not respond to things like pings, because pings could be a prelude to an attack, or at least some people may consider that.
Sure.
So you know, some of the early attacks that people, you know, so what they do is they'd hop on a network and then they would do a ping sweep, or, you know, they'd ping all the addresses they knew about on the network, and anybody that responded, they'd be like, oh, look, there's a machine I can attack. Well, if you don't respond to a ping, then that would eliminate that method of trying to find who's, you know, who's out there.
Sure.
And I've seen this sometimes too, like sometimes Traceroute, you'll get some things that you'll get stars, which I think are machines that are not responding. So one right. of the hops that are taken, the machine doesn't respond, but then the one past that does. So
right.
Okay, all good right. point.
So now we can move on to Ed, right?
Ah, excellent. Good.
Okay. So Ed writes, for a company that makes some powerful software, Adobe sure seems to cause us a lot of grief too. I recently started having beach balls on my Mac Pro, and looking in the console, I found something referring to error loading / library / scripting edition / Adobe unit types .osax, and then a whole bunch of other stuff ending with no matching architecture in universal wrapper. I did a little research and did not come up with anything useful, and Adobe provides no customer service that I could find. I'm all up to date for both OS X and Adobe Creative Suite 3. Any help would be appreciated. Okay. So, John, for this one, I did some searching, and I just took the error loading and, you know, part of his error message and searched for it. And I found a couple of forum posts that eventually linked me to an Adobe article where people said they had this problem and that this thing solved it. And sure enough, the issue is in this Adobe unit types .osax means it's an open scripting edition or an Apple script edition, right? Mm-hmm. Which is also given away by the folder that it's in, which is library scripting editions. Mm-hmm. As we've talked about, Snow Leopard introduces a lot more 64-bit functionality. The kernel is not by default 64-bit, but many components of the OS are. And apparently, the thing that monitors and manages scripting editions is 64-bit. The one installed with CS3, even with the latest updater, does not have 64-bit support. So that's presumably the error that Ed's seeing. And that's why Adobe released this alpha or beta version of this scripting edition. And the article on the web indicates how to take, you know, what you're about to download and replace the old one with it and do all this happy haha. So that's the issue in Ed's case. But okay. you did some research about this sort of in general, right, John?
Well, I'll add a little something here because I have seen a similar error. Yeah. So I guess the thing to mention is that no matching architecture, and no, we're not talking architectures in buildings. When we're talking architecture, we're talking about the architecture of the processor. And I think you're talking, and you nailed it, Dave, is that you're talking, I think, three major ones that you're going to have on any Mac. You're going to have a 64-bit Intel, a 32-bit Intel, and a PowerPC.
Okay.
Now, I've actually seen this, but I think the problem is, so I was speculating it may be that it was looking for a PowerPC version and Rosetta wasn't installed, but I don't think that was right.
Right.
So I think you may see a similar error message if you have an app that's trying to run some PowerPC code.
Yep.
But what I did find is that I actually, now I don't know if you know this, Dave, but I've actually been running for whatever stupid reason. No, it's just because I like to live on the edge.
Yeah.
My MacBook Pro, I'm running in full 64-bit mode.
You are, huh?
And I've been running that for several months because
Wait
the thing
a minute.
Is you...
I didn't think our MacBook Pros could do it.
Oh, ho! Yes, they can. Well, you got to get, there's a little thing called 32-bit or 64-bit. The thing is, our machines are capable of running a 64-bit kernel. They do not by default.
Right, Right.
But you can get this little add-on that will force it to run the 64-bit kernel. Okay. And there are some, and the benefits of this are, the thing, I just wanted to do it. Just
sure.
The thing is, you may be able to realize speed increases by running 64-bit versus right. 32-bit. The problem is, as I think we discussed in a prior show, is that not all components of the OS, this is the danger, not all components of you know, especially kernel extensions and things, may have 64-bit versions, in which case they will not work. Now, the only things that I've seen on this machine where this comes up is I think when I start it up and I look in the console, it tries to load the analog modem driver. And I do not believe there's a 64-bit. So I'm out of luck if I want to use my modem right. because it looks like it cannot find a kernel extension for /dev/modem. That's the gist of the message that I get. But other than that, everything that I've tried to run on this machine, Dave, has run fine booting into a 64-bit kernel. So so again, whenever you see something about architecture, it's either, I think with the most recent machines, it's in all likelihood a 32-bit Intel versus 64-bit Intel issue.
Right.
Or possibly you don't have Rosetta and it can't run the PowerPC code.
Right, right. Now that makes sense. Yep.
But yeah, I'm a good Google foo there that you found that, or Adobe foo.
yeah. It was Google foo. It was just, you know, happened to put exactly the right terms into the search window there. So, all right, our second sponsor for this show, and we do appreciate all of our sponsors, is Circus Ponies at circusponies.com with Notebook version 3.0. Now, Notebook, the idea behind this is, well, it's a notebook, except it's virtual. You run it on your Mac, and when you launch the app, you see a white-lined notebook interface in front of you. Yeah. Now, you can, if you want, you could draw in there, but you can type in there, and that's the idea. As you start typing, you can build it hierarchically. You can then start to pull in other resources. You can pull in PDFs. You can pull in pictures. You can pull in audio files. In fact, we had one listener who would start a new notebook for each Mac Geek Gab episode, pull in the audio file so that he had it as an archive, and then start going through and putting links in, any notes that he wanted to take, and really using it as a resource. Now, you could also do this for a class you were taking. It doesn't have to be a Geek Gab, even though it's kind of like an education here, right? But if you're taking a class at school, or if you've got to go for some education at the office, you know, this is a perfect way to do this. And then you can, if there's PDF resources, you can pull those in and you can mark those up too. Then when you're done, you can go and search throughout your entire notebook. And if you remember when you put something in, well, you can search by that. If you remember what you put in, you can search by that. If you tagged it with a keyword, you can search by that. So really the idea is you kind of dump your information in here. And then when you need to go find it, you look for the parts that you remember. And that's Notebook, circusponies.com. Of course, you can download a free trial once you're hooked or within 30 days. It's $49.95. And then there are bulk discounts if you want a family discount, which gives you a 3-user license, $99.95. And it's definitely worth checking out, circusponies.com. And with that, should we go on to who's next, John? You pick him. I want to make sure we do these two follow-ups at the end. So we probably have time for two more, one, maybe two more in the questions, and then those two follow-ups at the end. So pick it.
You know, I kind of, how about Kevin? The one at the end there.
Kevin. Yeah. All right. Good, good. I like that one.
Okay.
All right. So Kevin writes, recently, my father-in-law has participated in the World War II honor flights. The local news station, which is very cool, actually. The local news station covered the welcome home, as well as he was a recipient of a Pass It On feature segment for his volunteer work at the VA hospital. We have seen both web-based videos, but I cannot seem to find a way to capture them like I have from other flash-based downloads. While digital is forever, storage space is not. Therefore, I know that someday they will be off the news sites, lost to that great bit bucket in the ether. I would appreciate any advice you might have in achieving the goal of preserving these events for his grandchildren and beyond. So, yeah, some web-based, like YouTube, has a way of downloading flash video, right? And some other web engines have a way of doing this. But not everything does. And there's a couple of ways. Now, I like yours better, John, because it's more pure. So you go first.
All right. So what I did is I've seen this. So the thing, Safari is a... here's my recommendation. I'm just going to spit it out. I'm not going to spit because that'd be gross.
Please.
Firefox. So Firefox on the Mac, one nice thing about Firefox is that it offers a whole boatload of add-ons.
Okay.
And I've looked into this before. So what I did is I got into Firefox. I went to, I think it's the window menu add-ons, get add-ons, and I searched for Flash. They have a little, you know, little thing with tabs, and you say get add-ons, and it'll allow you to insert a search term. So I searched for Flash. And then it came up with a few things. None of them looked really familiar, but it had a little thing on the bottom that say see all results, and there were 10 of them. So I clicked on that, and then it opened a web page, and they had one called, what a surprise, download Flash and video. So basically at that point, then you can say, okay, install this plugin. What happens then is that it'll place a little icon in the lower right-hand corner of the current Firefox window. And then whenever, so this is the magic of what this add-in does, whenever it detects that there's Flash video available that it can grab for you,
yep,
it'll then put a little, one of those little movie scene markers, that they always click. So it's smart enough to, I think, look at the HTML of the page or whatever and say, oh, there's some Flash video. And all of a sudden what happens is this little movie scene marker appears. Well, then if you click on that, it'll say, hey, you want to download this video? Because normally, a lot of times, I think people will use Flash because one of the things it doesn't make it easy to do is to download the video. It's, I think, in a lot of cases, when you only want people to view it and not save it later. Fortunately, what this plugin did, and I verified this with one of the pages that he sent me, is as soon as I said download video, now the only caveat is what happened is this particular site had about four different pieces of Flash video. It had a lead-in for, I think, the station showing it. Then it had an ad. Then it had something else.
So it's up to you to sift through whatever the options are at that point, right?
Right. So at that point, I picked the last one because I'm like, well, that's probably the video that he wants. And I clicked on that, and it said downloading. So it started grabbing it. And then when I looked at the end result, it was a .mp4 file. I double-clicked on it, brought it up in QuickTime, played it at the same quality level that I saw it play on the web page using the Flash plugin. So
cool. For
portability, I think, now I don't know if there's any special plugin that I have in my QuickTime installation. I'm going to assume that it just wrote it out as an MP4 file, that there's no dependence on Flash.
Ah, okay. Well, okay, so I've got a couple things to add to that. First, and I'm looking this up because it's important. But so Parian at parian.org, Perian.org is, well, their name is the best. It's the Swiss Army knife for QuickTime plugins. So if you install, you just go and you install this on your Mac, and then it adds a whole boatload of plugins that will allow you to view different types of content inside QuickTime. So if you're having trouble with anything, you know, you mentioned you didn't know that you had any extra plugins installed. I've been in the same boat and told people, no, I don't think I have anything. And then that's right. I've got Parian in the background. So anyway, I throw that out there just in case you're ever having trouble. And I like your answer for this, John, because it will get you the best quality. It'll get you raw, you know, whatever the quality is on the web, that's the quality you're getting because you're getting the digital copy. If, however, there were no way of doing this or they blocked this somehow, my feeling is, if I can see or hear it on my computer, I should be able to capture it. And in fact, there is software to do just that. For video, I use Snaps 10 Pro from Ambrosia.
Excellent. Love those guys. I always use them for mostly for screen snapshots, but also they have a movie feature, which they introduced quite a while ago.
Yeah, right. So you draw a little thing. And, you know, you draw a little box around what you want to capture, or you can capture the whole screen. You set some parameters and you say go, and then boom, it just captures it. You can have it capture the audio. You can have it not capture the audio. But whatever it, you know, but you're doing a screen grab, essentially, a movie screen grab. So if you're seeing it on the screen, Snaps Pro can capture it. I haven't found anything it can't. On the audio side, certainly Snaps Pro can do it because it's doing it with the movies. But I turn to Audio Hijack Pro by Rogue Amoeba for doing just audio. For the same reason, you know, if you want to capture audio from Safari, it was funny because, you know, we used Audio Hijack Pro to do the podcast and you know, I'm using it constantly. I turn to it for everything. It was about, 2 years ago, somebody sent me a webpage it had some, you know, audio on it that I wanted to keep. I'm like, oh man, how would you do it? It was Paul Kent, actually. And he's like, dude, just use Audio Hijack. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. He's like, well, aren't you the one that told me about that? I'm like, yeah, never mind. I got it. So it, you know, yet another use for any of these. So we've now talked about three Swiss Army knife apps, right? Perry and, what's the other one? The Snaps 10 Pro and Audio Hijack Pro.
And now I just looked here at the video file, Dave. So I do not believe there's a weird dependency, because when I took the video that it saved and I did a get info on it in the more info section of the Finder, get info, gives the dimensions. And then it says codecs H.264, comma AAC. So
perfect. There,
so to me, this is a self-contained movie that he should be able to play in QuickTime or
iPod.
Shuffle it around to anything. So, but I like yours, especially the Snaps Pro one. I've actually done that sometimes when I've had a graphic that for some reason, if I try to resize it or scale it in a program and it doesn't do it properly, is sometimes I'll use another feature, like, you know, maybe change the display size, like, and then I'll take a screen snapshot with Snaps Pro.
There you go.
So anyways, you and I both love Snaps. I use it for all the screenshots I do for all the articles that I write.
So it's worth throwing out here while we're talking about Snaps. Sketch is another great screen grab utility. Mm. I don't believe it does video. I've never used it for video. I could be surprised and find out that it does. But Sketch is fantastic for screen grabs as well. So throw that out there. All right. We have a couple of follow-ups.
We didn't want to do another one?
I want to get through these follow-ups here.
They're good. Yeah, they're useful. Yeah. Okay.
So let's let Tom take the first one.
Hey, John and Dave, Tom from Escondido. I was listening to your episode where you're discussing the options for installing Boot Camp and an external drive with Windows when there wasn't enough room. And there was another option I thought of, which was just install Windows on the internal drive and install the Mac OS on the external drive and hold down the Option key when you boot up and you'll get your choice. There's no necessary reason, I believe, to have the Mac OS on the internal drive necessarily. That's just another option. You can cut me off here.
Cool. Thanks, Tom. Yeah, that's a pretty obvious one.
The only reason is if you happen to lose your external drive and you're stuck with a Mac that's running Windows, which...
That's a good point. Yeah, I wouldn't do it on a portable machine,
Yes. And then coming up, and then next we have our very humble friend.
That's right. No, Scott sends a lot of stuff in, and so much of it goes on for so long because he is so detailed that it just simply doesn't make sense to play in the show. But this, especially about those seemingly cryptic error messages, is just too good to pass up. So thank you, Scott. Here he goes.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Scott from D.C., Unix guru. I'm calling you about MacGeek app number 270. The first question about the error code -8003. First of all, what you're looking at is a holdover from a very old issue, old problem with Unix. Let's start with the error code. 8,000, it's not 8,000, it's hexadecimal 8003, which is a 16-bit number, which means that the sign bit is turned on. So what ends up happening is somewhere along the line, somebody played around with it and said, "Ooh, look, negative number," and stuck a negative sign in front of it and forgot to mask off the other bit. Okay, error no 3, which is the rest of it, happens to stand for, and I just lost my note in front of me, there it is, no such process, which means that no such process could be found with a corresponding process ID, which happens when you are deleting files to not an active file, because if a file is open under Unix, it just gets unlinked from the file system, but the inode, which is the underlining information on the file system, stays there. Even if the file is locked, you can still unlink the file, but you can't close it. There's a number of issues. What you have there is not a process that has it, but a driver that has it. Now, when you're using something like VMware, there are loadable modules that VMware does put on the system and does load on boot. And if you do the command V when you start up and look carefully, or you could probably read it in the console boot log, that you'll see a number of modules that will start up. What was deleted was more than likely a file that was being used by one of these modules. When you shut down and rebooted, the modules weren't loaded because they didn't exist anymore. So therefore, nothing had it. This is the cause of the operating system. It is very difficult sometimes for the operating system to diagnose these particular problems and hand this information back up to the UI, because quite frankly, they're not that usual. This is a systems-level problem, a systems-level issue when you're dealing with the VM software, VMware parallels. You are dealing with system-level hooks in order to make it run. So basically, what it's saying is it went to try to figure out how to be able to delete that file from an operating system level, but it really wasn't the process holding on to the file. It was one of these loadable modules, and therefore you confused the living daylights out of it. That's what you got. This is Scott from DC, Unix Guru, signing out.
Thank you, Scott. That was helpful and informative. Very interesting. Hadn't thought about it in that way, obviously, but he's totally right. And it makes sense, right? These loadable modules, what's the OS going to tell you? Even if it could figure it out, what's it going to tell you, right? I mean, it's going to tell you to reboot is what it's going to do,
And here's the fun. So I was, this was swirling around the back of my mind. Well, not when we got this problem initially. I had not even thought that the high bit being set in a 16-bit word would add that 8 or the negative thing. It was like,
right.
But anyways, but the 3 that he mentions, now that did bring up a distant memory when I'm certainly not at the level of Scott as far as Unix knowledge, but I did find the file that has these defined.
Really?
Yes, I did. It's called Erno, ErrnO.h.
Oh, right.
Which is one of these header files. So if you write C code, which I'm going to guess that a lot of this low-level stuff is written in C, this is a file that, a .h file is, at least in C programming, is a header file, and that's what you include with your code, and it defines a lot of variables, and it sounds like you're typing to find this now, Dave, and you'll find it all over the place. So it's ErrnO.h.
Yeah.
And hey, if you look in this file, it'll have a line here saying define ESRCH 3, no such process. Unfortunately, the person that wrote this put comments in here defining what each of these numbers mean, because to me, ESRCH doesn't mean a heck of a lot to me, nor do many of these other ones. Huh. But basically, these are so what it is these are kind of obscure standard Unix errors. And I guess people will typically include this file. And I guess it's shared among different versions of Unix. Of course, macOS 10 is a version of Unix. So.
Of course.
This maybe if you're running into an obscure error message that has the format that Scott mentioned, either a single digit or one that begins with 8,000, heck, try to look. I'm seeing others in here, file exists, device busy, bad address, access denied, all sorts of very low level, as he pointed out, very low level, kind of disastrous system level things that you would hope to never run into.
Sure.
But I did find it, ErrnO.h. Look it up. It's it may not mean a lot to a lot of people.
No, but some of them might, and there you go. So, cool. Awesome. All right, it is time to wrap this one up. So we are going to be on a brief, maybe not so brief hiatus. I am on vacation next week, which means we won't be recording any shows. We are doing one more show this week. On Friday, we will release a premium show. But this will be the last of the sponsored episodes before my return. Now, I'm returning on Monday the 19th, I think. But there's going to be a small little meetup on Monday the 19th. John, you and I are going to meet in, somewhere near Ledyard, Connecticut. I forget what town it is, but we're meeting.
What's happening there, Dave?
We're meeting at Mohegan Sun. Well, because you and I, we like to meet. Oh, and we might wind up going to a Rush concert that night.
What a Rush!
So we talked about doing a little tweet up for this, you know, a little meetup for the Mac Geek Gab. Mm-hmm. We'll tweet something out once we're there. And it would be great to meet up with any of you that are going. I know some of you said you were. So this is the 19th, nice. Right, John? Is that right?
Monday. It's a Monday. Yeah,
it's that Monday, July. I think it's July 19th. Yeah, it's July 19th at Mohegan Sun in Connecticut. So if you live close, even if you're not going to the show, come on out. We'll have a drink and whatever it is that we'll do before the show. And if you're going to follow us on Twitter to back us into the contact information portion of the outro here, you can follow me at Dave Hamilton. You can follow John at John F. Braun. You can follow Mac Geek Gab at Mac Geek Gab. And you can follow Pilot Pete at Pilot Pete. You can follow Mac Observer at Mac Observer. Anything else I'm missing there?
It makes so much sense.
It does.
And so, Dave, you know, if you wanted to, talking about contact info, if you wanted to call us, Dave, to just say hello, then don't just call and say hello. I mean, well, you can if you want. Yeah, and some people have. But if you want to call us and you know, submit a question or you know, ask us about the mysteries of life or something like that, I would call us, Dave, at 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335. And then you can email us at feedback@macgeekgab.com.
And I'm almost positive, Dave, you said feedback@macgeekgab.com, and the music just stopped.
I did. That's sort of weird that the music just stopped and just started again.
Actually, just loops. But that was feedback@macgeekgab.com, Dave.
That's feedback@macgeekgab.com, unless you're a premium subscriber, which, of course, we appreciate. And we encourage you to join us there. And it's premium@macgeekgab.com. And I believe that covers most, if not all, of the contact information. Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast is the one that converts this to AAC for us and for you. Cashfly@CACHEFLY.com provides all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace is, this month, includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, Text Expander and Text Expander Touch from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Gazelle.com with their Mac Geek coupon code for a 5% bonus. All that through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And John, I think that's it. That's where we get out of here, right? Have a great week, folks, if you don't hear from us before we leave. Hopefully, John and I will have opportunity to record a podcast on the 19th and release it, hopefully that day, hotel bandwidth permitting. But but otherwise, it'll be later that week. So, there you have it. You got anything to say to him, John, before we, or to me or anybody before we go?
The only thing I could think of, Dave, is you shouldn't get caught.
Made up.